I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong. It's Robin Young is off today.
And it's Here and Now.
That's the sound of emergency vehicles arriving at one of several locations throughout the capital of Spain today, following a series of deadly explosions. 10 terrorist bombs detonated on trains and in railway stations in Madrid during the height of this morning's commute. More than 180 people were killed and more than 1,000 are injured. An eyewitness described the pandemonium.
Muertos, heridos, la gente...
Dead, injured, people with blood all over them. People like me who are just going to school, who don't have anything. It's that the whole world was trying to get out.
The government has blamed the Basque separatist group ETA, although no one has taken responsibility for the attacks. Earlier, we spoke with Miguel Biena of the Spanish daily newspaper El País and asked him to describe the scene.
The rescue work is more or less finished, and hundreds of people are now in the hospitals. And in the scene, the railway is broken now, so you cannot at the moment go from Madrid to some big cities in Spain. And the country is really shocked. And the government and the different parties called for a big demonstration tomorrow in Madrid and all the Spanish cities. Is the worst attack in decades.
We heard that the hospitals are now appealing for people to come in and donate blood to help the victims.
That's right, but the answer of the population was very good, and in 1-2 hours, the hospitals, they had enough blood to attend all the people who were injured in the attacks.
Now, there was a phone call claiming to be from the separatist group ETA, denying responsibility, but the government claims that it was ETA who was behind these attacks. On what is the government basing its claims? What evidence does the government have?
Because in the last weeks and months, this terrorist Basque group tried to make this kind of attacks in another stations in Madrid, but the police was able to avoid these attacks months and weeks ago. So now was the same operation, but unfortunately the terrorists today they can make this attack. That's the reason why the government, the police, and all the political parties think that ETA is behind this attack.
Now, elections are scheduled for Sunday. Will this have any impact on the elections?
I think the population will vote more than ever before, in the sense to give an answer to this terrorist group and to prove that the Spanish population is with democracy and with our constitution. I think the reaction will be a very good reaction as citizens, and I think the majority of the Spanish population will go to the polls and to the elections on Sunday.
Well, Miguel, thank you for joining us.
Okay, you are welcome.
Miguel Biena is the foreign editor of the Spanish daily El País.
Joining us now is Gustavo de Aristegui. He's a member of the Spanish Parliament for the Basque region, who is himself Basque. He's speaking to us from Madrid. And Mr. de Aristegui, your government blames ETA, the Basque separatist movement, but a politician with ties to the group denies ETA was involved. What does that tell you?
Well, I think that this is probably a smokescreen that they're trying to build up and to make people think that they are not involved in this. But I want to remind you that it has tried to cause a massacre of this dimension before. In 1999, they tried to plant two vans loaded with explosives, one with 700 kilos and the other with almost 800 kilograms of explosives in the center of Madrid. Just imagine what that would have caused. And only recently, a couple of days ago, the police seized seized a truck, a van, with 536 kilograms of explosives that they wanted to plant in one of Madrid's busiest business districts. And that would have caused hundreds, if not thousands, of victims.
Yet when there's terror anywhere, Al-Qaeda comes to mind. There are unusual aspects to this bombing, the denial, there was no phoned-in warning. Given Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar's strong support for President Bush and given the presence of Spanish troops in Iraq, how likely is it that Al-Qaeda could be involved?
Al-Qaeda tries to target any democracy in the world, and we're not going to be an exception. And I don't think that they have to get any excuse to try to attack Spain or any other democracy. And you know the kind of reaction that France had to the war. They have threatened France quite clearly. Ayman Zawahiri said that France was top on their list simply because they had banned the headscarf in schools, in public schools and elsewhere. I simply don't think that this is a reasonable thing to say. I think that terrorism strikes wherever they can. But this particular attack, we think, etc., I think that the Minister of the Interior in Spain and the Prime Minister have said so, and there is no reason not to think that ETA was behind this.
Prime Minister José María Aznar has refused to meet with ETA officials to negotiate. A mistake?
Why should we negotiate? Would the United States negotiate with bin Laden? Should any democracy negotiate with terrorists? We tried to sit with them when they declared a truce in 1998, and the government sat with ETA in Zurich in Switzerland in May of 1999. It was very clear then that they didn't want peace or dialogue of any kind. They were just buying time, and they stole 8,000 kilograms, 8 tons of explosives then. They followed targets, and they prepared attacks. So that was exactly what they wanted. We cannot believe that ETA wants dialogue. They simply want people to submit themselves to their fanatical, oppressive, and violent ideology.
Knowing the anguish that you as a Basque feel about all this, I still ask you, how do you stop it?
I think that there is no shortcut in the fight against terrorism. If there is no immediate results in the fight against terrorism, that shouldn't probably discourage Democrats. We have to continue along the path. It is longer, but it's safer.
Can't a small group of terrorists continue to kill people almost indefinitely?
So what should we do? Should we yield? Should we just give up? Should we just let them impose on the majority of people what they want? The figures in the Basque country are very clear. I am Basque as one can be. My name tells you that. Half of us are not nationalist, and those that are nationalists, at least half, are not in favor of independence. And those that are in favor of independence, the vast majority of them, defend their ideas through peaceful ways. And they go to the polls, and they don't get a majority. And it's just a very, very small fanatical minority that supports violence and terrorism in the Basque Country.
Mr. De Aristegui, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Gustavo de Aristegui is a member of the Spanish Parliament for the Basque region.
Four weeks after they broke up in deadlock, Massachusetts lawmakers will reconvene this afternoon to consider a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. At this hour, hundreds of pro- and anti-gay marriage activists are gathered across the street from the State House on the Boston Common.
Let the people vote! One man, one woman! Let the people vote! One man, one woman! Let the people vote!
My name is Leighton Galea from Woburn, Massachusetts, and I think that gay marriage should not be allowed because, I mean, if God had intended for gay marriage to happen, he would have said so in the Bible. I mean, it clearly states that marriage is to be between one man and one woman.
My name is Michael Keenan. I live in Jamaica Plain. I'm here because I just couldn't stay home any longer. I think this is more than just separation of church and state. I've been with my partner for 22 years, and I think the time's right to not write discrimination into the Constitution.
All of this stems from a ruling late last year by the state's highest court. The ruling will allow same-sex couples to begin marrying in May. But some lawmakers are trying to stop that law from taking effect with an amendment to the Constitution that will make the practice illegal. WBUR reporter Audie Cornish is inside the State House. Hello, Audie.
Hello.
Now, can you explain, first of all, the resolution that lawmakers will take up today? What's it all about?
Well, right now, what they're trying to do is change the state's constitution so that it would somehow define marriage as being between one man and one woman. And there's a major faction who's pushing also for it to say that civil unions are available to same-sex couples. What's being debated really now is the language. Do they want something that guarantees the creation of civil unions, or do they want something that sort of allows wiggle room so that they can create them in the legislature as a statutory law in the future?
So the idea is ban gay marriage, but give couples the same rights as a married couple would have?
Yes, the lawmakers do not agree on very much, but one thing they do seem to agree on is that they do want something. They want to leave today with something that they can get before voters in the future. And it's really a debate over whether that is going to have language in it regarding civil unions or not.
Now, a very similar proposal failed at the last session by 7 votes. Is this an example of a compromise that nobody likes?
That's a great description of it. Last time, it did fail. This time, all of the state Senate and the House representatives, their leadership got together and crafted this compromise, hoping they could create something that the majority of the body would support. The variables here are some of the Republicans. They aren't remotely trying to get on board with something that would involve civil unions. Meanwhile, the more liberal faction and a much more liberal section of the Democrats don't want any amendment at all. They'd like to see the state's highest court, the ruling they made, they want that to stand. And so you've got 2 groups that don't want anything like this.
Now, according to the court ruling, gay marriages will become legal as of May 17th. So if the legislature does not approve any kind of ban today, what happens next?
Well, it's hard to say. Even if they did approve something, it likely wouldn't make it to a ballot until 2006. So no matter what happens today, actually, they do have to deal with May 17th. And the fact is there are no real sort of legal barriers right now preventing same-sex couples from going and getting licenses. As for out-of-state couples, people who may have hoped to come to Massachusetts to get married, there's a little question there because there's a residency statute on the books. But in terms of in-state same-sex couples, it's hard to see right now what will prevent them from getting their licenses on that day.
Audie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
WBUR reporter Audie Cornish spoke to us from the Massachusetts State House.
Just ahead, when sports take on a deeper meaning, Pakistan meets India on the cricket field today.
And later in the show, the pros and cons of outsourcing. We talk to an economist and a congressman.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
India and Pakistan have fought several wars since 1947, when the two countries were partitioned. And since the two countries became nuclear powers, the world's watched with dread each time tensions have worsened or actually flared into fighting. But since last fall, a peace process has been underway. Indian and Pakistani officials have negotiated troop redeployments and examined border issues, with the question of the disputed region of Kashmir always foremost. Now, the latest sign of reconciliation has to do with cricket. For the first time in 15 years, India and Pakistan will play each other in the sport that's a national obsession in both places. This week, the Indian cricket team arrived in Pakistan, trailing some 10,000 Indian fans. Today, the first match took place in Lahore. Pakistan won. Joining us to explain how a mere game can amount to much, much more, we're joined in the studio by 2 journalists, one Pakistani and one Indian, currently traveling, both of them, in the United States. Pervez Bokhari is from India, and Amara Durrani is from Pakistan. Amara, welcome.
Thank you.
Pervez, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Amara, you told me that you're not a cricket fanatic like some of your countrymen and women. What will you be watching for as these games go on?
I would, first of all, as a social scientist, as a journalist, I would be looking for public reactions. Two words, the match between India and Pakistan, the arch rivals first. I would then be looking at how the nationalist propaganda, the antagonist nationalist propaganda that has been ingrained into the social psyche over these many years, how that would play out into these matches, particularly against the backdrop of the recent peace initiatives that have been taken by the Indian and Pakistani government. And I would look at the political actors then who would try to manipulate these matches, perhaps for their own vested interests, the hardliners in particular, and I would look at the governments and how they respond to these challenges.
Pervez, 10,000 Indians expected to travel to Pakistan for these cricket matches. How do you think they will be received, and how unusual is it for that many Indians to come to Pakistan?
It certainly is unusual. It definitely will be watched very, very closely how these Indians will behave while in Pakistan watching the cricket matches, and how Pakistani crowds will actually react. You know, they're not going there just to watch a cricket match. It'll also be a fight between the attitudes towards the game and towards each other's countries of the two populations watching this cricket series.
Amara, we're having this conversation in the city of Boston, where there's this fierce rivalry in baseball between the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox, which sometimes actually flares into violence on this much grander scale between India and Pakistan. Do you anticipate violence, and what would the consequences be if there were?
I don't anticipate violence as such. Yes, there are many passions, fierce passions. There is euphoria that is often manifested in terms of fierce slogans, sloganeering, protests, a few cursing of players who didn't do well on the enemy ground, but it has never transcended that level. So I'm sure that there would not be any violence as such.
What about terrorism?
That is a concern which has been expressed by the Indian government in particular, in the sense that it wants reassurances from the Pakistani government that the Indian players would be secure and when they go to Pakistan, that they are not attacked by the hardline factions, the hardline groups who profess this enmity against anything that is Indian or Hindu. So yes, that is a concern, and anything to say on that would be pure speculation at this point.
Pervez, three wars in 60 years between India and Pakistan. Why is there an effort toward reconciliation now?
I think there's a growing realization in both the countries that the conflict is not the hostility doesn't exist between the people. It's been more between the two governments, and the governments have realized that we need to allow the people to come together again, because it's ultimately the same culture, it's the same language. We've been the same country before 1947, and there's a growing realization that we need to grow together as two peoples.
Okay, Amara, having established that there are going to be these cricket matches and there's this reconciliation between the leaders of the two countries, what has that led to? One hears of it becomes easier, for example, to fly between the two countries.
Yes. Right? Well,
how has it affected average people so far?
Interestingly, there were no flights to each other's countries until the very beginning of this year. The flights had been banned.
It's amazing.
Immediately after December 13th attacks on India in 2001. 2001, yeah.
So on the Indian Parliament.
Yes. So we have had communication bans. We have had absolutely no travel across the borders, whether it was flights or land or bus or railways. That, during the past couple of months, has beginning to change. We first had the bus links restored, and then we had the railways restored, and now we have the flights restored. So what we see is a lot of activity across the borders between businessmen, between journalists, between common people, between tourists, between students, and now we have sportsmen. So, yeah, that's bringing a lot of people together from various aspects, yeah.
You know, there's a saying that countries that have McDonald's don't go to war with each other. Is it true? Perhaps, is there an analogy to countries that play cricket together don't go to war against each other?
Well, I hope it's true. I hope it becomes a standard understanding of sorts now that we've started playing again with each other.
Amara, what do you think? Is this a hopeful? Obviously, it's a hopeful moment. But are you reserving a part of yourself, having seen so many flare-ups and indeed war between these two nuclear-armed countries, that you remain cautious?
No, I think we'd like to think so, but if we look at Indo-Pakistan history, that has not been the case. Cricket has not stopped India and Pakistan from going to war against each other, and we've had four wars so far, so cricket is not the barometer to decide that. But let us hope that the larger peace initiative, which has led to this restoration of cricket ties between India and Pakistan, that has longevity, that has sustainability to prevent war in the region.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Pervez Bokhari is an Indian. He works for Star News. Pervez, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Amara Durrani is a Pakistani who works for News International in Karachi. Amara, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
A quick correction. It's not, as our lead said, the first time India and Pakistan have played each other in cricket in 15 years. It's the first time that's happened in Pakistan in 15 years.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
The outsourcing of U.S. jobs to places like Mexico and India is likely to be one of the more contentious issues in this election year. Congress is now weighing in with several new pieces of legislation meant to stem the flow of jobs out of the country. One of them is sponsored by Vermont Congressman Bernard Sanders. He joins us on the line from Washington. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Thanks. Now, your bill would ban companies that outsource U.S. jobs from receiving federal money. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, what the thinking behind it is that in the last 3 years, we have lost 2.8 million good-paying manufacturing jobs, and now we're beginning to see the hemorrhaging of very high-paying white-collar information technology jobs. The result of that is the middle class is shrinking and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. This is unsustainable. Now, that whole issue bothers me very, very much. But one thing that really bothers me is that many of the largest corporations in this country who are shutting down plants in the United States, who are outsourcing good-paying jobs, these are the same exact companies who receive billions of dollars in corporate welfare from the taxpayers of this country.
Corporate welfare meaning what, specifically?
Meaning money from the Export-Import Bank, meaning money from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and a variety of other programs which ostensibly are designed to create jobs. So you have a company like Motorola, for example, who has laid off 43,000 workers since 2001, and yet they received $190 million in corporate welfare from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, ostensibly to create jobs. So to me, it is absolutely absurd for large corporations who announce very publicly, we're going to be laying off American workers, we're going to China, we're going to India, and then they come marching into the U.S. Congress. They say, oh, give us some money for job creation, when in fact they're laying off combined millions of American workers.
Now, business groups argue that some of this federal money is meant to help companies sell American products overseas. So couldn't it actually harm the job situation here if American companies sell less abroad?
But these are the very same companies that are laying off huge numbers of American workers and announcing very publicly that they want to go to China.
But presumably it could make their situation worse.
If you told me that you're going to be laying off tens of thousands of workers, but you really need some more money, billions of dollars, because it could even be worse. Does that make a lot of sense to you from the position of an American taxpayer? What you want to do is go to employers, and there are many in the United States who say, look, I want to create decent paying jobs in America, and I want to work with the government to do that.
Let me ask you about a specific example. Boeing says it manufactures aircraft parts in China in order to help it sell aircraft there, and that if it didn't outsource that work, the company would be in danger of being locked out of the multi-billion dollar aircraft market in China. Do you accept that kind of argument?
No, I'm just looking at a statistic right now. Since 1990, Boeing has laid off 135,000 American workers. They are increasingly outsourcing design work to China, Russia, and Japan. And since 1990, they've received $18 billion in corporate welfare. We are spending a fortune, and we're giving it in many instances to the wrong companies. And that takes us then to the broad issue of the disastrous nature of our trade policy, most importantly, permanent normal trade relations with China, which basically say to large corporations, sure, you can go to China, you can lay off American workers, hire people for 20 cents an hour, and bring your product back into this country. No problem. Well, I think that's a bad idea, and I think we have to rethink our entire trade policy.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Congressman Bernard Sanders is an independent from Vermont. He joined us from Washington.
To continue our discussion on outsourcing, we turn to economist Barry Bosworth, who joins us on the line from Washington, D.C., where he works at the Brookings Institution. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Bosworth, you heard Congressman Sanders. Why should a company that receives money from the government to shore up its business and at least in part to create jobs be allowed to ship jobs overseas?
Well, I think, first of all, they're two completely separate issues. I would fully agree with the congressman that it's time to stop the subsidization of various types of American companies. And the experience he cites just show how ineffective those type of policies are. But it's a completely different issue to talk about whether or not the United States should try to withdraw from the global trading system. During the period that he's talking about 2.8 million jobs lost, which I don't understand quite where he got that statistic, the United States economy has created 20 million new jobs. The issue is somehow moving jobs overseas that are white-collar different than any other form of trade? And I think the answer is no.
Well, you know, Congressman Sanders talked about the hemorrhaging of those high-paying white-collar jobs. And just a few years ago, those same jobs were being touted as replacing lost factory jobs. Now those jobs are disappearing. Is this churn in the economy just something we have to learn to live with? Every few years, workers are out of work?
Some workers are out of work. Yes, this economy has a lot of job churn. But people should not lose track of the fact that the United States is the most effective economy in the world in creating new jobs. The United States in the 1990s had this dramatic reduction in our rates of unemployment and tremendous growth in jobs. Now, it is true in the last few years, because of this high-tech collapse, we have a difficulty about why employment is not growing as rapidly in the total economy. But it does not seem to be related to some outsourcing of computer programmers or something like that to India. It's a gross exaggeration of what the sources of our difficulty on the employment side are. This is a typical business cycle problem we've had before, and we've had a long history that there is some things that we import from other countries. The jobs, in effect, move overseas, say, for textile products, and we export to them other things in return.
But is that a typical business cycle? A Georgetown University economist, Harry Holzer, observed that the U.S. economy hasn't suffered such a prolonged decline in payroll jobs since the Depression. Shouldn't extraordinary measures be created for extraordinary times?
Yes, I think we should be doing more to try to get job creation in the United States. I don't know that you do that by trying to block trade with other countries and trying to say that somehow high-tech jobs are American jobs. We keep those. The rest of the world can't have any. I agree this recession has been one, a very mild recession, but very long-lasting. And so far, the government's actions to try to do something about it by getting the economy going again have not worked very well. We should focus on that problem, not try to blame our problems on other countries.
At the same time, at the beginning of our conversation, Mr. Bosworth, I think you did suggest that you are, to a degree, uncomfortable with what Congressman Sanders calls corporate welfare.
Yes. I think it's a great mistake for the United States to be engaged in these various forms of tax reductions and other subsidy programs to American business. We should try to make sure that our tax system treats everybody the same. We want a uniform tax system without special provisions for different groups, whether they be people or companies. And in the recent years, we've gotten away from that. I think it's some of our economic difficulties.
Barry Bosworth joined us from Washington. He works for the Brookings Institution. Barry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And still to come, where do prima ballerinas get their toe shoes? We'll visit a factory in London, England.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our piece on independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader's possible effect on the November election by costing presumptive Democratic nominee John Kerry votes prompted a response from Zygmunt Plater, an environmental law professor at Boston College. He compares Nader to Mary Mallon, better known as Typhoid Mary, the cause of several deadly typhoid outbreaks in the early 20th century. He writes, Ms. Mallon couldn't bring herself to believe she had caused deaths and illness to those who were exposed to her cooking. And when the attention to her first episode had died down, she stubbornly returned again to her deadly ways. It must be hard for Mr. Nader to admit that his actions in 2000 turned the reins of his country over to a group of extreme right-wing activists. In this light, it's understandable how hard it must be for him to admit to himself the harm he caused, as he tries to take the same course in 2004. Like Mary Mallon, he's lost our sympathy this time.
Walter Crinian of Fountain Hill, Arizona, wrote in response to our segment on mysterious elk deaths in Wyoming. During our interview, we asked how environmental toxins could get into such a pristine area. Walter writes, it's a reasonable question, but one that reflects a commonly held myth regarding toxin exposure. Environmental man-made toxins are a global issue. Numerous studies have documented pesticides, solvents, etc., traveling thousands of miles.
Our interview with John Toner, a Massachusetts man who, along with his dog, received electric shocks from a manhole cover while walking in Boston, prompted Nicholas Bodley of Waltham, Massachusetts, to call our listener line.
I was very nearly killed by electrocution, and I know firsthand how awful the experience can be. I say this is nothing short of negligence to a criminal degree. There's absolutely no excuse for it.
In our discussion on political humor, one of our guests mentioned an often-told joke about Vice President Al Gore claiming to have invented the Internet. This prompted Felix Ulrich of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to write, Al Gore did not claim to have invented the Internet. Stop propagating this lie about Al Gore. Well, you're right. According to Snopes.com, the Internet myth-debunking website, Al Gore never claimed credit for inventing the Internet, but said as a congressman he helped create the environment for fostering the development of the Internet. And we have a couple of other corrections.
In our segment on President Bush's call for a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, our correspondent Andrea Stone said that the last time a constitutional amendment was sent to the states was in the 70s with the Equal Rights Amendment. As Eric Siegel of Providence, Rhode Island points out, in fact, the 27th Amendment, an attempt to restrain Congress from setting its own salary, was finally ratified by the states in May of 1992. On the other hand, it was originally proposed in 1789.
During our segment on a new documentary film on the controversy over Somali immigration into Lewiston, Maine, we called Lewiston a town. But as Bill Carlson of Billerica, Massachusetts points out, Lewiston is Maine's second largest city.
And if you have corrections or other thoughts, we love to hear from you. Our email address is letters at here-now.org. That's letters at HERE-NOW.ORG.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
The toe shoes that ballerinas wear are often the stuff of dreams for little girls. Pink satin with ribbons around the ankle. They give the ballerina the look of effortless grace. But toe shoes are not easy to wear, and they're not easy to make, as Here and Now's Lynn Menegon found out on a recent visit to London, England, where she went to a toe shoe factory and to Covent Garden. There, she spoke with one demanding ballerina, Leanne Benjamin, principal dancer at the Royal Ballet.
I'm quite obsessive about my shoes.
Tell me why.
Think about them, actually. Because when I have the perfect shoe, I'll have the perfect show.
Have you ever had the perfect shoe?
Occasionally. More not than often, shall I say. The worst I've had is that I did a filming of Coppelia live several years ago, and I wasn't supposed to do the filming, and the girl went off on the day, and my shoes were probably a little bit old, and the shoe came off the heel in one of my solos, and I had to do the whole solo, and it was live performance. It didn't show, but I kept going, but I mean, that's, you know, that's like your nightmare.
So you get the call to do Coppelia live, and you're thinking...
The only thing you're thinking is shoes. Well, apart from, oh, I have a million people watching in the audience, you know, live on BBC. But the first thing to me will be, what shoes will I wear? Because they're handmade, you know, they're all going to feel different. So that, you know, we'd actually, in this case, like a machine. But, you know, just to make them all like a production line.
My name is Patrick Cornelius. I'm the factory manager at Fried of London. The point shoe is made by an individual man, not by a team. We have 25 different craftsmen, some of whom have been making this type of shoe for more than 40 years. We produce in the order of 5,000 pairs a week, and they go all over the world. We're standing now in front of a maker called Raymond. Raymond has a symbol that he puts on his shoe, which is a crown. Each maker has an identifying symbol or letter to show that he made the shoes, because the point shoe is ordered by maker. The maker is very important to the individual dancer. Some dancers will have been using shoes made by the same man for most of their dancing life. The shoe is in fact made inside out. Looking at the shoe the right way, there's a layer of satin. There are two layers of a thin cotton. And into those three layers, we place burlap, heavy paper, which goes in a moist condition and spread with a paste. At the end of the day, we bake them in that oven there for 12 hours at a low heat.
You don't burn the satin.
That's right.
So the hardened point of the shoe is really layers upon layers of material and glue.
That's correct. For the professional dancer, we know that they're not going to last much longer than one performance. This is Taksim. Taksim is the maker for Leanne Benjamin at the Royal Ballet Company.
Where are you from?
I'm from Cyprus. Anka is my own personal symbol.
So it means on the bottom of the sole, on the leather, on the bottom of the shoe, there's a symbol of an anchor.
Yes.
Now, the point of turning shoes inside out, how can you turn a shoe that has so many materials, how do you turn it inside out?
Because the paste is very soft in the air now. And that is what it starts shaping off now.
And now you take your hammer?
That's right. I take my hammer.
Give a few good whacks on the sole, on the toe. And you're making the platform of the shoe, which is the thing that the dancer stands on. Use the hammer to smooth out the bumps underneath the satin. Very distinctive shape. That is your shape. That is the anchor shape.
Very, very, very flat. And then that's how I make my shoes.
Now, do you ever go and see the ballet?
I never been ballet.
Have you met Leanne Benjamin?
No.
She's right here in London. You're holding a pair of shoes that she will get to know intimately.
Okay.
And there you are, making them, and you're right in the same city. You haven't met?
I never met, you know, because, you know, we're making lots of production in here, and then lots of performance and lots of shoes.
Good afternoon, Royal House, stage door.
For some reason, I haven't met this particular maker. But he does a lot for my shoes. I've had to change my shoes quite a lot since coming back from pregnancy, as you can imagine. He sends different batches and says, try this, I've done the heel slightly higher. I mean, if you went down and had a look at my place downstairs, well, mine is just shoes. Someone will come and look at this, my bench, and go, my God, and I will know exactly which shoes will be fine and which won't be. You know, I'll have the shoes that I know I can only wear for rehearsal. I wouldn't be seen dead on them on the stage. And then, you know, your performance shoes, which you might say have 10 pairs on your place for, and you might find two or three that are good out of that pile for that particular performance.
And what are you looking for in a shoe?
You want to have the perfect platform. And then as for the other things, that's up to me how I produce a shoe. To start with, I get a fresh pair of shoes. I will shellac the shoes once, maybe twice, on the inside of the shoe and dilute it with, I think it's some sort of spirit. It's highly flammable, by the way, so don't do this at home. For all those budding ballerinas. I leave it first time maybe for a night or two nights in between and then shellac it again very mildly just to give it an extra bit of support because it's like a cake almost. It's actually like a cake. When it's come out of the oven, it's soft, more pliable. So basically you don't want to wear your shoes straight from the factory. You actually want to let them settle in a little bit to harden themselves up. Before I wear them the first time, I will bend the back up.
Oh my.
Yeah?
Oh, that beautiful shoe.
Yeah, they completely get destroyed now. I will just bang under the sole. Is anyone out there? You want to bang under the sole just to take away that noise. What I do is open the door and put the shoe in the inside of the door.
In the hinge.
In the hinge and close the door slightly. So that's softening the toe and just spreading the shoe out a little in the toe area.
And this is the only way that the shoe really works for you.
Yes, it looks like we've just bought them and popped them on.
Far from it.
And far from it.
Do you ever get the point in the day where you've done massive amounts of rehearsing and you look at your shoes and you go, oh my God, I've got to do my shoes. It's like time to make the donuts.
Yeah, you wear them out often quicker than you've spent to prepare shoes. And that's the tragedy of it all.
Do you ever want to encase the perfect shoe in a glass and measure them and photograph them and send them back to the maker and say, please?
Yes, I've done that before, but, you know, it just never happens. Just no two shoes feel the same.
Our visit to Frieds of London and the Royal Ballet was produced by Here and Now's Lynn Menegon. For photographs, visit our website at here-now.org.
Recapping our top story, more than 180 have died and as many as 1,000 have been injured in Madrid in today's terrorist attacks that hit commuter rail stations and trains. 10 bombs are blamed. Prime Minister José María Aznar is calling the attack mass murder, and he says the bombings look like the work of the Basque separatist group ETA. ETA has denied responsibility for the attack.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.